October 23rd, 2012 in Vrindavan. Nectar of Devotion, Chapter 11, Part 1. This is I'd call this a really sweet chapter. Don't have the mic on. We're dealing here with almost coming to the end of the 64 items. If it makes too much noise, just turn it off. I can talk loudly. And the first thing, we should pass around the paper. For questions, please. Now, it's interesting to have an item of devotional service called servitorship, because in one sense, everything we do... Now, I know you're not translating, so can you do that later? Is that all right? Okay. If you're translating, you can do it now, otherwise... So it's very interesting to have a category called servitorship, because in one sense, we can say that all the devotional service we do is serving. Jivara Swara Prayar Krishna Arana Chidasa. Everything is serving Krishna, even indirectly. Everybody who's in Maya is also serving Krishna indirectly. Have you ever meditated on that? It's such a cool thing to meditate on. So let's say that there is a very demoniac, evil person, you know, who wants to commit murder. So who's he going to murder? He's going to murder somebody who's destined to be murdered. Well, that means he's doing Krishna's plan. That means he's serving Krishna's plan. So even the evil persons are all serving Krishna. Krishna's able to weave them into his plan. I think about a river that's going down to the ocean. So the river is going to go to the ocean. And if there's a rock in the way, if there's a drop, whatever, it's going to go around the rock, under the rock, over the drop. Somehow it's going to get there. And Krishna is so clever that he weaves all of us and our intentions, good, bad, and indifferent, into his plan. So everybody's serving Krishna. So what is this servitorship? So Srila Prabhupada makes the point here that in the Skanda Purana it says that servitorship means varnashram. Means people who are doing varnashram, and not just doing varnashram, but doing varnashram and offering the results to Krishna. But Srila Prabhupada makes the point here that he says that the acharyas don't accept this. He says that actually the acharyas don't accept that this is really servitorship. That you can call such persons devotees, Prabhupada says, because they're offering the result to the Lord, they're accepted as devotees, but they're not pure devotees. And Prabhupada is defining servitorship differently. So the Prabhupada is saying here that servitorship are people who are offering the direct result to Krishna, the direct activities to Krishna. Now, Srila Prabhupada does say that devotees may also end up doing some of the items of varnashram. But when they're doing the items of varnashram, they're doing it with a different consciousness. Their activities are aimed at satisfying the Supreme Personality of Godhead. All right, let's look at the difference here for a minute, because it's a subtle difference, but it's an important difference. And I see that in ISKCON, we often have controversies over the role of varnashram. We talked about this before because it's brought up in Nectar Devotion. You can all hear me? No problem? It's brought up in Nectar Devotion many times. And I know I pointed this out before, but it bears repeating. It's very easy to think that we're performing bhakti when actually we're performing something else. You know, I was giving class in Prabhupada's quarters the other day, and one of the devotees said, "I haven't made any progress in 20 years. Now, first of all, when people say that, it often isn't true. Like I read something a devotee wrote today. He said, I've been in Vrindavan for 2 years. I haven't made any advancement during that time, but I have realized that I'm not as advanced as I thought I was when I came. And I said, well, that's called humility, and that is advancement. You know, what are you looking for? What are the symptoms that you're looking for? But Srila Prabhupada does say that if we're performing devotional service, we should feel satisfied. Just like when you're eating, like we just finished lunch, and I was given a second lunch, and I said, I can't eat it. I'm already full. I'm already satisfied. So I don't have to ask anybody. Prabhupada says you don't have to ask somebody else, did I eat? Am I satisfied? You know if you're satisfied. And Prabhupada says if you're eating but you're not satisfied, then either you're not really eating. Were you here yesterday? He said that either you're not really eating, or there are some parasites in your stomach, in your intestines, that are taking the nourishment from the food. So if we're performing devotional service and we're not feeling spiritually enlivened, we're not feeling that we're making advancement, then either we're not actually performing devotional service, we're doing something else, or we're committing serious offenses that are stealing the nourishment. Now, I find that a lot of preachers focus on the offense possibility or probability or definite ability. That they're assuming that our problem must be offenses. And in many cases, that's true. In my own experience, I see that it's very easy to offend other Vaishnavas. And it's very difficult not to offend Vaishnavas. That's what I just see in the society of devotees, in myself, and the devotees that I work with. So it's hard not to commit any of the offenses. So we can assume we're committing some of the offenses. But we might also look at the question, which I think is discussed a lot less frequently, are we actually performing bhakti? Or are we performing something else? What's our definition of bhakti again? Yeah, why don't we say it together? Anya bilasita sunyam yam karma anavritam anupurayam shamachinam bhaktir uttamam. All right, so we know that we should not be coming to Krishna with some motive. That anya bilasita sunyam doesn't mean that you have to be free of material desires to start pure bhakti. Remember, that was not one of the eligibility requirements for starting pure bhakti. We didn't say eligibility requirement, you have to have zero material desires to start. But that can't be your motive. You can't be coming to bhakti for the purpose of fulfilling your material desires. And you can't be covered by karma and gyan. Covered by karma and gyan. Covered by karma is almost the same thing. It's saying that you're performing bhakti, but your real purpose, what's the purpose of karma? Why do people engage in karma? What do they want? Sense enjoyment, particularly heaven. People want heavenly sense enjoyment. People don't just want sense enjoyment. They want to live in a beautiful home and a beautiful environment, to have an attractive, loving partner, an attractive, loving family, and a beautiful body, and comfortable, beautiful clothes, and delicious food, and right? They want a heavenly standard of enjoyment. That's why right now in India, people, and not only in India, many places, people are trying to imitate Western Europe and America and Western countries like Australia, because they're feeling, well, those places, it's all like heaven. Which, of course, if you live in those places, you see that it's not exactly heaven. You know, although perhaps compared to some of the living standard in the rest of the world, but it's not really heaven. But anyway, that's what they're looking for. Karma means I'm looking for heaven in this life, in this body, and I'm looking to go to heaven after this body. And we see that most of the religious people in the world are looking for heaven. The vast majority. It doesn't matter what religion they're in. So, you know, the Christians who are preaching, if you serve Jesus, you'll be prosperous. and you'll be happy in this world, and then you'll go to heaven. And the Hindus who are doing all their sacrifices for the demigods and so forth with the idea that I'm going to get this and that heavenly facility. Now, there's also a level, because Prabhupada's talking about acting in Varnashram and then offering the fruits to Krishna. In other words, doing an action. So this is one symptom that your activities are covered by karma and that your activities are materially motivated. I mean, how do you know? Because conditioned souls, someone who's not liberated, by definition, a conditioned soul is somebody who wants sense gratification. That's what it means to be a conditioned soul. If you say, I don't want sense gratification, but I'm impure and I'm a conditioned soul, it doesn't make any sense. Does everybody follow that? That's the definition of a conditioned soul. So if you say, well, I'm not a pure devotee, but I don't care about sense gratification and I have no material desires, it makes no sense. It's illogical. It's incompatible. So it's understood that if I'm a conditioned, first of all, what is my symptoms of a conditioned soul? Well, I'm going to be moved by pleasure and pain. I'm going to be, you know, if there's pleasure, I'm going to feel happy. If there's pain, I'm going to feel unhappy. I'm going to be affected by the modes of material nature. I'm going to be affected by illumination, attachment, and delusion. I'm not going to be in a state of constant transcendental bliss. I'm going to be affected by lust, anger, envy, greed, and illusion. I mean, there are symptoms. So if we have those symptoms, maybe to a greater extent, maybe to a lesser extent, maybe 10 years ago, 20 years ago, we had them more, and now we have them less, hopefully. But even if you have them, how are you going to tell, okay, well, how am I in pure devotional service? And one of the ways is noticing, am I doing pious activities and then offering the result to Krishna? Or am I offering everything to Krishna all the time? Is the activity itself being offered to Krishna? And it sounds like it's a subtle difference, but it's something that you can discern. And that's one of the differences between these two kinds of servitorship. The one that Prabhupada is saying, it's devotion, but it's not pure devotion. It's not an uttama bhakti. It's karma mishra bhakti. It's karma covered bhakti. And actual uttama bhakti. You're welcome. That's everything. Now you can be a teacher. Probably much more than you'll ever use in there. And hopefully I didn't give you anything I wasn't supposed to give you. So the fruit of mentality works like this. My purpose in what I'm doing is to get a certain fruit. Again, I know I've talked about this before, but it really bears repeating. My purpose is to get a fruit. So why am I, you know, cultivating the ground, planting a seed, watering the tree, weeding the tree, putting a fence around the tree, pruning the branches, and so forth? Because I want mangoes or I want apples. That's my purpose. If I don't get any apples, it's not worth it. We used to have a peach tree in our backyard when we lived in Detroit, Michigan. And when we first moved there, we got incredible peaches. White flesh, freestone, and we picked them tree ripened. And I felt like I'd never eaten a peach before in my life after eating those. And it's a long time before I was willing to eat peaches from the store after eating those peaches. But gradually over the years, we lived there about 10 years, the tree produced fewer and fewer peaches. Obviously, we needed to do something with that tree that we didn't quite know how to do. And, you know, eventually, if a tree doesn't produce any more fruit, you're just going to cut it down. And you just focus on the fruit. I remember also we had a cherry tree, and the cherries, the flowers bloom very early in the year, so that if there's a late frost that kills the flowers, you get no fruit. So we counted the value of the tree in terms of whether or not it produced fruit. So what we call fruitive activities, or as Prabhupada's talking about here, the activities of Varnashram, they're done for a fruit. They're done. You want to get something, and the something you want to get is material happiness. You may sometimes be working for the fruit of moksha also. We were studying this in Bhakti Vaibhava, how Bhishma was saying that the activities of the four varnas and the four ashramas can all be divided into dharma, artha, kama, and moksha. So sometimes the fruit one wants is also moksha. But the way you can judge your mentality is like this. I'm gauging my success, and I'm gauging my happiness, and maybe even I'm gauging my spiritual advancement on something that happens periodically at the end of an activity. I'm doing an activity, and that activity has an end, and at that end there's a certain result. And I'm judging the success of my life and the success of my time by that particular external result. Do I get the fruit? Does the tree produce a fruit? Does the tree produce a fruit? Does it taste good? Does it have worms in it? That's how I decide. Am I Krishna conscious? Am I making advancement? And so forth. And my focus is on offering that fruit to Krishna. So I'm cooking an offering, and my focus is that when the cooking is done, what's the quality of the offering? And then I offer that to Krishna. And then afterwards I taste the prasadam and I say, oh, okay, I did a good job, or I didn't do a good job. And I feel happy or unhappy as far as the taste and the quality of the preparations and whether or not I got to finish. You know, if I run out of gas in the middle of the cooking, then it's a failure. If I offer to Krishna and it's not, you know, properly spiced, it's a failure. If somehow or other I didn't get to offer it to Krishna, I tripped on the way with the deity's plates and all the food went all over the ground, then it's a failure. So that I'm judging by that fruit. And my concept of the fruit is, although I'm offering it to Krishna, I'm offering it to Krishna with the concept that Krishna is going to be more like a karma stamping out machine. It's like in a factory where there's a conveyor belt and you put your things on the conveyor belt. You all familiar with that? My father used to run a factory. So I used to, when I was a child, I used to visit. It was a food factory. And, you know, you put things on the belt and it goes through the machine, right? And they would make crackers. So you put the dough and you put it on the machine and it goes through the oven and the oven bakes it. So, you know, we're taking our activities, like we take our food, we offer it to Krishna, Krishna removes the karma, and then we can eat it without sin. So we're thinking, okay, I'm taking what I'm doing, I'm offering it to Krishna, and then there's no sin. So that's not actually servitorship. The mood is still fruitive. The mood is still personal enjoyment. And what's really interesting, because Krishna says, ahankaravi mudat makarta hamiti manyate, the mood is very much I'm the doer. That there is some cause and effect going on here, and that I'm the cause and the result is the effect. I'm creating this effect and I'm going to enjoy that effect. I planted the seed, I watered the tree, I pruned the tree, I fertilized the tree, and therefore I get to enjoy the fruit, but because I want to be a spiritual person, I offer the fruit to Krishna. That's the whole mood of the demigods. And that's, as I said, the mood of pretty much all the religious people in the world. And a small percentage want moksha, a small percentage want salvation, and pretty much everybody else has this mood of, I want to enjoy the world, I want to be the master of the world, but I want to do it legally. I want to be a good citizen. You know, I don't want to be a thief. I want to pay my taxes. I want to enjoy without some sort of bad karmic reaction. I mean, everybody wants that. Everybody wants to enjoy without the reaction. In fact, I was saying this to a devotee the other day about getting rid of an artist. Devotee was telling me how he was struggling with a very serious anartha, and he prayed to Krishna over and over again for years, please remove this, please remove this. And I said, a lot of times, we don't really want Krishna to remove the anartha, we want Krishna to remove the suffering that comes from the anartha. We want to keep the attachment, but we don't want any suffering from it. And we're really asking Krishna, just get rid of the suffering. So Everyone's thinking like that. Everyone is thinking, I want to suffer, I want to enjoy without suffering. I want to enjoy without reaction. And intelligent people figure out, well, if I want to do that, I have to go to God. Only God can remove the attachment. Now, the mood, the servitor mood of the devotee is quite different. The servitor mood of the devotee is, I'm Krishna's servant. My business is to please him. The results are up to him. I mean, they're also up to me. It's not like they're not up to me at all. I'm one of the five factors of action. I have some...
It's fine.
I have some influence on the result. But I'm not the whole cause of the result. You know, you can cook to the best of your ability. So when I went to Puerto Rico, I was there maybe a day, and they said, what would you like to do? I said, I can do whatever you want. I was there to take a vacation. I was there to take a 3-month vacation, and I was going to pretend that I was a Brahmacharini again. After which I decided I really didn't want to be a Brahmacharini again. But anyway, so I was pretending I was a Brahmacharini then, living in the Brahmacharini ashram. And they said, what can you do? I said, well, whatever you need. And they said, well, we really need a cook. I said, okay, fine. This was in 2000, I think, 2001, maybe beginning 2002. Can't remember, somewhere around there. This maybe it was 2002. So I was cooking the main meal for all the devotees, which had to be cooked in the morning. So I was cooking rice, dal, sabji, chapati, salad, halva, juice, something. Anyway, so I was cooking all that in the morning. And then I was cooking maybe for 2 days. And they said, our Sunday feast cook is going to India. For Gaur Purnima, would you cook the Sunday feast? I said, sure. So I had two assistants, one who didn't speak any English, she only spoke Spanish, and another who only made the juice. So I had to make everything with my assistant. So I've always been very proud of my ability to cook rice. I really like rice, and I've always been like, I know how to make really good rice. So I set up the rice in two pots for the Sunday feast. But Puerto Rico is a very breezy place. It's a tropical island, and there's a lot of wind, and all the windows are always open. And so the wind blew my fire out. Now, if any of you know how to cook rice, it's very important that you have the flame just right when it's cooking. I remember David Richardson was saying how he once ate rice, and he said, how did they make the bottom burnt, the middle mush, and the top uncooked? And I thought, I know how you do that. You just have the flame too high. So I couldn't get the flame, and you don't notice it because you're also making pakoras and puris and sabji and this and that, and you know, you're making 15 different preps in a new kitchen, you know, where you don't know where anything is. You know, where's the hing and where's the turmeric? And I asked this other lady, and she just speaks Spanish. And so it was a little difficult to watch my rice. And then you look at the rice, and there's no fire under it. And then you, oh my God, when did the fire go out? How long was it cooking for? Because rice, you have to time it exactly, perfect. You know, and then I would turn it on again and stir it again. And then the fire would go out again. Oh, when did the fire go out? And then it... And pretty soon it was getting time for the offering, and I didn't know what to do, you know, so I'm just putting more water into the rice, and I have the flame up a little too high, and putting in water and stirring it, and so it wasn't very good rice. So my point is I couldn't control the result, but I should tell you the rest of this story about how you can't control the result. So we serve at the Sunday feast, and I find out after that feast that the main food in Puerto Rico is
rice.
And that everybody's going to judge the feast by the rice. And the rice was not very good. I mean, it wasn't abominable, but it was pretty close to abominable. It was mush, you know. So it was really bad. It was really, really bad. And I had this one devotee who ran the restaurant. She came into the kitchen the next Sunday. She was kind of a heavy-duty lady. I mean, if you think I'm heavy-duty, multiply that by about 300. And she came into the kitchen, and she said, I'm coming to cook the rice. I said, look, I know how to make rice. It'll be okay. Are you sure? You're sure you're not? I said, yeah, I'm sure. I can do it. No, no worries. So I decided instead of using the big stove, I was going to use the candy stoves because they were very low and they were under the windows and they wouldn't get the breeze. The breeze wouldn't blow out the flame. And everyone also told me the rice was too plain. They said it was too mushy and it was plain. You need to have some flavor in the rice. Okay. So I picked from Jamuna's cookbook the most difficult rice. Curry rice, which I'd made many times before, but never for, you know, like 200 people. And it has, it's very complicated. You have to take eggplant and peel it and soak it in haldi with salt. And then you have to take a bunch of spices and fry them and then grind them. And it has like many, 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 many different steps. And then you have to put it all together. And I mean, it makes a nice rice. So I went in the kitchen, I don't know what time, like probably 6 in the morning, to cook for the feast just to make this rice. I thought, I'm going to make the best rice anyone in Puerto Rico has ever had in their life, and they're all going to love me, and they're going to love the feast, and everything will be wonderful. And the rice was perfect. It was completely perfect. And then the devotees, I had about 5 people come up to me afterwards and said, why did you make an Indian rice? These are not Indians. These are Puerto Ricans. There are maybe 5 Indians in the whole island, you know. And they said, you don't, this is too much. Too much spices, too much flavor. I mean, I was practically crying. And one of my god sisters came, we joked about this for years later, you know, my rice story. So then again, you know, I had this same woman come back and she came in the next week and she just started doing things. I said, out of the kitchen. She said, I'm going to make the rice. I said, no, you're not. I'm going to make, she said, this is your last chance. She said, if you mess up the rice this time, finish. I thought maybe that wouldn't be a bad thing. But anyway, I was, you know, I had a lot of ego that I've got to do this right and I'm the doer. So then I thought, all right, let me make a rice that has flavor, but not so complicated. So I made it with whey and with grated carrots and a little bit of nutmeg and a little bit of sugar. So little flavor, maybe a little vanilla also. And I made it again on the candy stove. So that time it was perfect, and then everybody was happy. I still got stares from that lady for the next week or so I was in the temple. But that's very fruitive. If one's thinking like that, my cooking's a success if everybody likes it and it turns out nice. You know, and when it didn't turn out nice, the first time I was really, like, depressed. And when the second time, when they didn't, and it was perfect. I mean, I was so happy with it. You know, after the offering, I took a little bit and tasted it. Like, yes, it's perfect. And they still didn't like it. And hardly anybody ate it. They said, we don't eat curried rice here in Puerto Rico. You know, I was devastated. I thought, oh, now I failed, and so forth and so on. But that's fruitive. That's a fruitive mentality. I'll tell you one more story. So we had a grand opening for our school in Detroit. We'd had a school for years and years and years, but it was in our house and it wasn't legal. And one devotee did something really stupid so that the government always knew we had a school in our house and it wasn't legal, but they didn't bother us. But this one devotee innocently did something very foolish. So the government was forced to acknowledge that we existed. You follow? They knew already, but she like made them deal with it. She wrote down on some official papers that her children went to our school at our house. And so they came to our house. They said, you can't have a school in the house. This is against the law. You have to have a proper building. So we moved the school into the prasadam room, which was very difficult because we had to lock everything up every night. And and devotees were always walking in and eating in the middle of our class. And then we built a school building. We built a, you know, regular legal building. So we were going to have the grand opening ceremony. And we spent quite a bit of money. We invited the Festival of India. We paid like $1,500 for them to come. We had a big stage and the students were going to put on a big drama. But this festival was also going to be a way for us to make money to pay for the building. And there were some politics going on. And so the way that the people told us to raise money was not the proper way. They were supposed to guide us, but they gave us bad advice. They said, have a dinner where you ask $200 per person. And then some of the leaders, they told everybody, it was on a Sunday, they told all the regular Sunday feast guests, don't come to the temple this Sunday because they're going to be asking everyone to pay $200. And they closed the restaurant. So we usually had hundreds of people and nobody came. I mean, we worked for weeks and weeks and weeks, you know, bringing in the Festival of Inspiration, having people that paid us to sell prasadam and sell other things. And we worked for months on a drama. And I remember we made little invitations. We had them specially printed with Sanskrit verses on them. And at those days, you couldn't get a Devanagari font. My son designed the Devanagari font, and we drew pictures of Sarasvati. And we printed it on cardstock, and we used a sewing machine to perforate the places between the tickets. And I mean, months and months and months and months. And on the day, there was nobody there. There's nobody there. Maybe 10 people. And not just a normal Sunday feast, we got probably 200 or 300 people. But the two of the people in the temple leadership had actually, we found this out later, they told everybody to stay home. So, you know, we had this whole dinner planned where $200 a plate. Nobody came, and one person came. You know, and if you're thinking, okay, I'm doing this for the fruit, then it was very depressing. You go to this big festival, and all these people were there to sell prasadam, and they had paid money to us to have a booth, you know, and they were all complaining. We did all this cooking, we bought all these ingredients, and now there's nobody here. It was so embarrassing. And the children performed their drama, and there was nobody in the audience. Even the parents weren't there because they thought they'd have to pay $200 to see their children on the stage. I'm laughing now, but I definitely was not laughing on that day. I was kind of walking around in a state of shock, you know. I was just like, what's happening here? How did this happen? And if you're thinking the success of what I'm doing is by the result, you know, then what happens? If the result is good, then you're celebrating and you're happy and it's wonderful and you think Krishna's smiling on you and everything's lovely. And if the result isn't good, then you're devastated. So remember yesterday when we were talking about dealing with difficulties and always expecting the Lord's mercy, and we talked about, what was one example of difficulties we talked about? We talked about for quite a while. Not just, you know, losing your money, you're getting sick. We talked about a specific kind of difficulty. I asked you all for examples.
Failures.
Where your service is a failure. You try to stop Ravana from killing Sita and instead you get killed. You try to stop the cows from running down Govardhan Hill and they run down anyway. You try to console the gopis and they still miss Krishna. I love that one. That was great. I was thinking about that yesterday. It's so sweet. So that if we have that mood, just like we also read one of the 64 items is not to become affected, not to become jubilant when there's something good or lament when there's something bad. So if we're doing that, it's a sign that we're actually not doing bhakti. We're doing something else. We're doing karma mishra bhakti. We're doing karma covered bhakti. We're still thinking about the fruit. We're still thinking about the result. We're still thinking we're the doer. We're still looking for our happiness in the fruit. So what does one do instead? I've talked about this before, so let's see if anybody remembers. What do we do instead? Because Prabhupada talks here about the other kind of servitorship, the real servitorship. What is that in contrast? And we've talked about it here before.
Accepting
the will of the Lord. Yeah, we're actually going to get to that in one of the other items today. But what's the mood of the devotee who's actually a servitor? When am I doing it for Krishna?
All the time.
All the time. When am I offering my work to Krishna?
As you do the shopping, as you conceive of the shopping list.
Yes.
And through all the stages.
Exactly.
Not just the offering.
That's right. That's right. And you're doing it with detachment from the fruit. You have a right to perform a prescribed duty, but you're not entitled to the fruits of action. Never consider yourself to be the cause of the results of your activities and never be attached to not doing your duty. So at every moment, not even every day, not even every hour, not even every half an hour, but at every moment, I'm offering this to you, Krishna. I'm offering it to you. I am your servant. I'm doing this because this is what you want. And I'm doing it for your pleasure. That I hope that you're smiling on me now. You know, I hope you're smiling at me while I try to keep fixing the rice when the flame keeps turning off. Not just when the rice is finished. Not just when the devotees are eating it afterwards. You know, that I'm not doing it for those things anymore. I'm not doing it for how many people show up. Like Prabhupada would say, that Bhaktisiddhanta would say, if nobody comes, you preach to the walls. And sometimes in Prabhupada's early preaching, he was recording himself speaking to an empty room. No, that it doesn't matter. We're not in charge of that anyway. You know, it's just not under our control. I mean, I just gave you some examples from my own life, but I'm sure each of you have stories like that to tell, where you worked really hard and you put a lot of intelligence into something and a lot of care and a lot of planning and maybe even a lot of money, and maybe even other people worked on it, and it failed. And even it was something, you know, that you knew that Prabhupada wanted and you knew that Krishna wanted, and it didn't work out the way that you intended. So it's offering every moment. And when you offer every moment to Krishna, I'm Krishna's servant. Okay, what does Krishna want me to do in this minute? Because this minute also is all you ever have. Now, the very famous writer C.S. Lewis, that you're probably familiar with in terms of the Narnia books, if you're familiar with him at all, he also wrote a wonderful book called Screwtape Letters, which both Jai Dwaitaswami and Ravindra Prabhu say is one of their favorite books, so I'm not ashamed to say it's one of my favorite books. And in Screwtape, C.S. Lewis talks about how that when people are in illusion, they're focused on the past or the future, which is very much this nasochati nakanchati, hankering and lamenting. You know, we're hankering for the future, we're lamenting about the past.
What's the name of the book again?
Screwtape Letters. It's a very unusual book. It's a short book. It's a book from a senior, it's a parody. It's written as if from a senior demon to a junior demon about how to make human beings forget God. Screwtape Letters. It's quite a good book. C.S. Lewis very, very clearly understands the mentality of a neophyte devotee. He doesn't really understand higher levels, but he definitely gets the neophyte. He definitely gets beginning sadhana bhakti quite well. He's a very interesting writer. So there he talks about how ordinary people, they're always focused on the future, or they're lamenting for the past. Which is, again, a fruit of mentality is focused on the future. What's the fruit I'm going to enjoy over there? And only occasionally are you in the present, eating your fruit. Right? Every once in a while, you get to a point where you can eat a fruit. And then it might not even be a good fruit. Maybe there's no fruit. You know, maybe the rice gets burnt. Maybe nobody shows up for the festival. Maybe there's no peaches on the tree. And then you're so disappointed. And how do you keep going? You plan for the next fruit. Right? And so your life is basically a series of austerity, sacrifice, disappointments, hankering, with occasional brief bits of pleasure, maybe. Maybe. And that's your whole life. That's all it is. What a miserable life. You know, always working for something in the future. And that's also why people get very angry when they're blocked. Like the way Krishna describes the demons. You know, he's my enemy, I've killed him, here's my other enemy, he'll also be killed. You know, if because we're so focused on the fruit, if anyone prevents us from getting that fruit, or we think anybody might be preventing us from getting the fruit, then we want to clear them out of our way. And again, you can see we can do this in the name of Krishna consciousness. We can do all these things in the name of Krishna consciousness. Actually, Bhaktivedanta Maharaj, when giving a seminar in Japa, talked about 4 or 5 results of intentional, inattentive chanting given by Jiva Goswami. I don't remember the source that he quoted, I have it in my computer, but I don't remember it. And one of the effects that Jiva Goswami gives of intentionally inattentive chanting is that you judge your advancement by your accomplishments. So I remember visiting one temple in India, and this one brahmachari greeted me at the door. I'd never seen him before in my life. I didn't know who he was. And he starts giving me his resume. It was kind of odd, you know, his CV. Well, I am so-and-so Das, and I am the temple commander here, and before that, I was here, and I did this, and I did that, and he's going on for like half an hour telling me, and I'm, you know. And then he looks at me, and he says, and so what department are you in? I didn't know what to say. I said, I'm in the troublemaking department. He didn't quite know what to say. But I really, when I heard that seminar, and I thought, that's what this devotee was doing. He was judging his advancement by his accomplishments. You know, we normally do that. If we're going to introduce a speaker, we list their accomplishments. Or we get, you know, an obituary, we list what they've done in life. But that's not really, that's not what Krishna's looking at, really. That's not what makes it bhakti. Because you can't control that. You just can't. Even if you're a pure devotee, we gave the example of those failures yesterday by pure devotees. That's not under our control. That's under Krishna's control. Prabhupada talks about this all the time. The profit, the loss, that's Krishna's business. So if we just have the mood, I'm in Krishna's company. I've talked about this before, right? Krishna's my company president. And what does he want me to do? What's our product? What do we sell? What do we sell? Krishna Prema. We sell Krishna Prema. That's our company product. And I'm always working for the company. And everyone's my supplier, co-worker, or customer. And I'm always trying to sell love of God. And I'm trying to do that now. And I'm trying to do that the next now, and the next now, and the next now, the next now. This absorption with fruit, what C.S. Lewis talks about absorption in the future, it's really nice the way C.S. Lewis puts it. He says that of all three phases of time, the future is the most illusory because the future never exists. He says at least the past actually existed, but the future never exists. It's never the future. So anyone who's absorbed in the future is the most disconnected from reality. And since I did some research, you know, from Srila Prabhupada, Bhaktisiddhanta, Bhaktivinoda Thakur, where they talk about how in the spiritual world, it's ever-present. There's no question of past or future. It's always the now. Now, of course, if you meditate on that a little bit, your brain will go spinning in circles. Because it means that all of Krishna's pastimes are happening simultaneously. Although there's the Astakaliya Lila. But there's only the now. So hankering for the future and being absorbed in wanting to enjoy a fruit in the future, we become very, very disconnected from Krishna. And it's one of Maya's very clever tricks. You know, you're, whether or not this is service is dependent on what fruit you get, and then you offer the fruit to Krishna. That is karma, measure, bhakti. And if we're performing karma, it's so easy to do that. Why? Because that's what we're used to doing in the material world. We're used to being fruitive workers. And okay, now I'm going to be a fruitive worker for Krishna. We don't even realize that's what we're doing. And then we don't get satisfied. Like if you're eating and you're not satisfied, you're not eating, you're chewing gum. You're going through the motions. And there's something in your mouth and there's some taste, but there's no nourishment. Or like a lot of the modern food that's just chemicals, right? Is no, you know, they advertise zero calories. That means zero nourishment. No real food. It looks like food, tastes like food, something like that. Not, it doesn't taste exactly like food, but tastes something like food, looks like food. But it's not food. And when you eat it, instead of getting nourished, you get diseased. So karma misra bhakti is like that. So servitorship is, what we're looking for in servitorship is not that. Now Prabhupada points out that someone who's a real servitor may also be doing some activities that are done in varnashram. Because some of the activities of varnashram are the same as some of the activities in bhakti. Which activities in varnashram are the same as some activities in bhakti? What?
Vanaprastha.
Could be, not necessarily. You could be a vanaprastha or a sannyasi as just to go to heaven. It's like, not necessarily. There's sacrifices, yes. So definitely there's sacrifices in varnashram, which may be exactly the same as a sacrifice in bhakti. What else is in bhakti and in varnashram? Something identical.
Offering activities.
Okay, offering your food.
Studying
the Vedas. Okay, now studying the Vedas are the activities of what persons in varnashram particularly?
Brahmanas.
Especially the Brahmanas. And this is really a side point, I'm not going to get into it, but just I want to mention it. That one reason sometimes there's confusion about varnashram is that not all, but some of the varna activities of a brahmana are also some of the nine main activities of bhakti. Some of the varna activities of a brahmana, like worshipping the deity, studying the scriptures, teaching the scriptures, those are also part of the nine processes of bhakti. So if you're doing them, are you doing material varna activities or are you doing bhakti? Sometimes it's hard to tell. And the confusion between those two things, I do not have time to get into this today, but the confusion between those two things leads to a lot of trouble. So we may sometimes look at those activities and say, okay, these can only be done by brahmanas. It's hard. You know, we can distinguish between a material activity that's being offered to Krishna if it's something like painting a house. Then we can say, okay, painting a house is a materialistic activity, but if I'm doing it for Krishna, it's spiritual. However, if I'm worshiping the deity, is that direct bhakti or is it spiritualized Brahman Varna? The answer is that depends. That depends. But Prabhupada's making the point here, especially saying the householders, but because the householders are the main people who do varna activities. One of the advantages of the grihastha ashram, and this should be clearly understood, that if someone who's in the renounced ashram is giving this up, one of the advantages of the grihastha ashram is that you can do things to make a living. You can do the full range of varna activities, which you really can't do in the renounced ashrams, technically. From a varnashram point of view, maybe from a bhakti point of view you can, but not from a varnashram point of view. Therefore, Bhakti Siddhanta Sarasvati, when he took sannyas, stopped doing astrology. He said, this is not an activity for a sannyasi. But anyway, the point is that devotees will do things that are also done in varnashram. Of course we will. People in varnashram will get married, they'll have children, they'll study the Vedas, they'll go on pilgrimage, they'll give charity, right? We're going to do all those things. But the difference is we're not doing it for fruit of results. We're doing it because we're saying, okay, I'm a servant of Krishna, I work for Krishna's company. What does Krishna want me to do right now? Maybe Krishna right now wants me to give charity. Maybe Krishna right now wants me to support my family. Maybe Krishna wants me to study the scriptures. But I'm doing it because that's what Krishna wants me to do, because that's what's going to increase my love of God and my distributing of love of God, and I'm offering this moment to Krishna. Now, I talked earlier about how you can't influence the results of your activities. You can't even influence whether or not you finish. Srila Prabhupada never finished translating the Bhagavatam. I think many of us, you know, especially those of us like me, I wasn't actually here in Vrindavan when Prabhupada left. I was in New York. Those of us who didn't see how ill Srila Prabhupada was, you know, we were thinking, well, Prabhupada's not going to leave. He's been sick so many times before. He's going to stay until he finishes the Bhagavatam. But he didn't. It was inconceivable to us at the time.
I also wondered about that. Because he never finished
the Bhagavatam. I mean, when you think about it, Most of the great acharyas left the world while they were in the middle of writing or translating something, because they were always writing or translating something. So they, you know, unless they left within like a half an hour before they finished one thing. And Prabhupada was working on more than one thing at once also. There was a lot of books that Prabhupada wanted to translate and didn't. For example, he wanted to translate Vedanta Sutra. Never got a chance to do that. Or when, especially at the end of my graduate studies, because Tamal Krishna Maharaj left his body 3 months before he got his PhD, before he would have gotten his PhD. And especially when I got to those last few months, you know, and especially every time I got in a car. Every time I got in a car in those last few months, I'm thinking, suppose I die now. Suppose I don't finish my degree. And when I was a teacher of children, so especially when you're teaching children, you're teaching for future. You know, that's your focus. I'm teaching the child so that they'll be able to use this as an adult. And I would think, every day, I would think, if these children die today, is what I'm doing still valuable? Is it bringing them closer to Krishna today, now, this moment? You know, I had a student die when she was 3. And it's there. So the result may not even come. The tree may get knocked down before it even gets a fruit. You may never have the mango rotten or not, worms in it or not. So that, this one lecturer, Prabhupada said, the difference between material consciousness and spiritual consciousness is very small. It's like two lines paralleling. Just move one a little bit, and all of a sudden it's over there. It's a very small difference in consciousness. It's not a big shift, and you don't need to be an Uttama Adhikari to do it. But this little shift completely changes your life. Completely. If you switch to, I'm working for Krishna now, in this tiny little speck of time, not even this 5 minutes or this 10 minutes or this hour or this day, not even a chunk, that now, and I'm offering this to Krishna now, and I want to connect with Krishna now, and I want to meditate on Krishna smiling at me now, and I'm offering this to Krishna now. And you can think about the result, like we were doing yesterday, the Brahmana who was meditating. You can meditate on offering the result to Krishna as if it's already done. You can do that. That's a nice thing to do. While you're cooking your rice, you can meditate on Krishna eating the finished rice. Now, while you're cooking it. As if he's already eating it while you're still washing the rice and while you're putting it on the stove. Oh, Krishna's eating this rice. He's eating this rice. He's enjoying this rice. Krishna's enjoying this rice. Immediately, you will feel satisfied by your devotional service. Immediately. I mean, it will just shift. You'll feel connected with Krishna. You'll remember Krishna. Someone was asking me yesterday. I don't think they're here today. How do you remember Krishna when you're doing things? That's how you do it. It's not difficult. Prabhupada keeps saying it's not difficult. It isn't difficult. You'll be connected with Krishna. You'll think about Krishna. You'll feel happy. And you'll be free. You'll be free from hankering and lamentation. You'll be free from being affected by other people's criticism. You'll be free from, you know, you'll be free from being dependent, as Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, on auspicious or inauspicious things and the ordinary course of events. Because that's not where you're getting your happiness from anymore. You're not getting your happiness from how do things work out in the world, which you can't control anyway. What a state of anxiety. My happiness, just think about it. My happiness is dependent upon something that's going to happen in the future, and it's never the future. My happiness is dependent on something that I have a very small amount of control over. My happiness is dependent on something that may never happen. How much anxiety are you going to be in? Be a constant state of fear and anxiety and anger and so many things. My happiness is dependent on something I can't control. Oh, wow. What life. Or my happiness is dependent on something I can control, which is how much am I connecting with Krishna now? Now, you can't control how much Krishna chooses to connect with you now. That's something else. but my happiness is dependent on how much I'm connecting with Krishna now, how much I'm offering to Krishna now. So that is actually the servitorship that's accepted by Srila Prabhupada, by Rupa Goswami, by the Acharyas. And the other, although it's still counted as, you can still say the person is a devotee, they're not in Uttama Bhakti. It's Karma Mishra Bhakti. And they will not be getting those first two, what are the first two things you get? In sadhana? Kleshagni and? You won't be getting those. Because you're not going to be in sadhana Uttama Bhakti. You're going to be in something else. Remember, the yoga ladder is basically, you're, you know, suffering with the idea that you're going to get to heaven later. It's basically the idea of the yoga ladder. Yes. And then we're going to go over the other things after our break.
How can you remember Krishna if somebody's working on a job too intensely for some long time?
Well, we talked about that, and this Prabhupada talks about in this section. You know, and he also talks about it as surrendering everything. No, it's in being a surrendered soul. Isn't there, or surrendering everything? Which one is it? Yeah, it's in surrendering everything. While offering himself as a fully surrendered soul, he said, "My mind, my household affairs, my body was ever in possession. I offer to you for your service. Now you can do with them as you like." We're not, see, you're not really maintaining your family. Who's maintaining your family? Are you maintaining your family? Can you control whether or not you maintain your family? Can you control that? Yes? No? No. Who's doing it? Krishna, what are you doing? You're serving Krishna. And he's maintaining you, and he's maintaining your family. Now this goes on to the next section. But we can cover that, and then you guys need a break. So this goes on to, we'll skip friendship for a minute then. And surrendering everything to the Lord, it goes to that. So surrendering everything to the Lord, there's the three selves, body, the mind, and the soul. So when I'm surrendering everything to the Lord, and Prabhupada says here, you know, you don't think about your maintenance. You just think about serving Krishna. So a lot of people think, oh, okay, I know what that means. By the way, if we don't have the fan on or the AC on, can we have the windows open? So people, somebody could open the windows, that'd be really nice. So people may think, okay, I know what that means. What that means is, I just sit in the temple, and I just chant japa, and I just go to the kirtan, and I don't go to work. It's not on. Do you follow? When Prabhupada says things like, you don't worry about your bodily maintenance, you don't worry about the maintenance of your family, you just do devotional service and Krishna takes care. They think it means like that. They think it means, well, I just sit in the temple and I just clean the temple and I chant and Krishna sends the money. Now that can also work. That worked for Srivas Thakur. He had his 1-2-3 program. But generally, like Mahaprabhu went to him and said, why aren't you working? Mahaprabhu didn't go to him and say, oh, very nice, you're not doing anything. So the devotee's doing their duty, but they're doing their duty as they're offering to Krishna. That this is what Krishna wants me to do. So this mood of servitorship and this mood of surrender are very interrelated. These two angas of bhakti. When one is in this mood of servitorship, one is thinking, whatever I'm doing, whether it's brushing your teeth or whether it's working at your job at the, you know, grocery store or the bank or whatever work you're doing, no, I'm doing this because this is what Krishna wants me to do. This is what's pleasing Krishna. I'm doing this to please Krishna. And he's maintaining. I'm not maintaining. How can you maintain yourself? It's not possible. You can lose your job, your house can burn down, so many things, right? How are you in control of that? You're not. So you let go of that. You just let go. I'm doing what I'm doing as a service to Krishna. And whatever the result is, that's Krishna's. Marobi rakobi, sampare vipare. So that's also surrender. So to have servitorship without surrender is a little difficult. You know, you can. But it's like the next step. Okay, now I'm offering everything. I'm offering every minute to Krishna. I'm offering every minute to Krishna. I'm offering. Then the next step, servitorship, is whatever Krishna gives me in return. That's up to him. You know, a normal servitor, they're depending on being maintained by the person they're serving. And of course Krishna will maintain. Yoga Kshema Bahamyaha. But Krishna may not always maintain exactly the way you think, exactly how you think, and when you think. You know, my kids were renting a house in Govardhan town, and they started having severe problems with the electricity and the water. They started not having every day or every other day, they wouldn't have any water, and they'd have to walk to a pump and, you know, pump the water and carry the buckets. And they kept having electrical fires in the walls. You know, fire actually coming out of the walls. It was just slightly scary. You know, and this was going on for maybe 2 or 3 weeks. And finally my son-in-law said, he just prayed, you know, please Giriraj, can you give us, that's why I just better open the windows. He said, please Giriraj, can you just give us stable water and electricity? I hate to ask you for anything, but please give us stable water and electricity. And the next day the landlord came and said, you have to get out of here. I want this house for my family. You have 3 days to leave. So they're thinking, you know, what are we going to do? It's a catastrophe. And then they ended up staying at his stepmother's house in the MBT for the next 4 months, and they had stable water and stable electricity. So, you know, Krishna has his funny ways of taking care of us that may not correspond to our particular idea. I mean, Prabhupada talked about that with himself. He said, you know, I left my children and now I have thousands of children that are much better than my own children. Sometimes Prabhupada called us all his mothers and fathers also. So, you know, sometimes we don't like the way Krishna takes care of us. Or I had an incident where I was preaching at one center where they had candles like this high. And I didn't see them. Little candles. You know, those little votive candles with the flames only like this big? I just didn't see them. They were like this high. So after the program, I was talking to one of the guests, and my jacket caught on fire. I didn't see the candle. You know, I looked behind it. Oh, my God. You know, I take off my jacket, and I looked at it, and it was like, okay. And the people I was staying with who ran this center, you know, they looked at it, they said, can it be fixed? And I said, I don't think so. You know, so they felt responsible. So they took me out shopping. And while we were shopping, I found this, because I travel with just one little bag. Just one bag about this big. And I found a winter coat that weighs, what it should weigh, like, say a kilo is 2.2 pounds, would be less than half, about a third of a kilo, 10 ounces. And it packs up this big, a winter coat. I'd been looking for something like that for like 5 years while I was traveling. And while they went to get me a replacement little thin jacket, I saw this thing. And the person who was taking me shopping was rather wealthy. And she said, would you like that? I'm like, yeah. She said, well, I'll get it for you. Okay. And, you know, my losing my jacket meant that I got, not only did I get a new little jacket, but I got this other thing, which I really needed. When I went to Europe, it was 20 below this last winter, one of the coldest winters they'd had in like 30 years. And I really needed something warm, and I had something warm, all because my jacket burned up. You know, so I see Krishna takes care. So this is the mentality when you're working at a job. You're not working at the job, I am the hero. I am the maintainer of my family. I am the protector of my family. I am doing my dharma. You know, that then you're a muddha. I mean, Krishna says that. I'm not calling you muddha. I write a letter to Prasanta. Ramila's calling us muddhas in the classroom. But if we think like that, then we're full. But if it's instead, this is my service to Krishna, like Bhaktivinoda Thakur says here. this wife, these children, they're Krishna's. They're not mine. They're not mine. His husband is Krishna's. It's not mine. It's not my husband. It's not my wife. Just reading this letter from Prabhupada. He said, naturally a woman is attached to husband and children, but she should be thinking, I'm serving my husband and my children to please Krishna. I'm thinking, this is my duty to take care of my family or, you know, elderly parents or whatever, whoever you're working for. This is my duty to Krishna. Krishna gave me this duty. Prabhupada says in Bhagavad Gita, we should think whatever we're doing is being given by Rishikesh. This duty is given to me by Krishna. I should do it so he's smiling and he's taking care of the maintenance, not me. And Krishna has all kinds of ways of maintaining us. He's very clever. He doesn't just maintain us with your paycheck that you're getting. He maintains you in so many ways. And he can choose not to maintain you the way you want. I mean, it's up to him. Krishna can decide, okay, right now it's better if you're in poverty. Like sometimes a doctor may say, right now it's better if you fast. And you don't think the doctor is evil if the doctor says you have to fast for 2 days. So sometimes Krishna says, you know, best thing for you would be to fast for a few days. So that surrender of the body particularly, and surrender of the mind. You know, I'm using my body for you, whatever you want to do. So servitorship, I'm giving now. And surrender is whatever you give back to me is fine. I'm not the cause of what's coming back, and whatever you give back to me, I accept. I'm doing my service and you're maintaining me. I'm working for Krishna as my company president, not the head of the computer company I'm working for, not my husband, not the temple commander. Krishna. Only Krishna. So that is the surrender. And again, this is not a hard thing to do. It just is not a hard thing to do. It's not difficult to do. There is a kind of surrender that is hard to do, and we'll get to that after a break. Please take 10 minutes. Thank you. Hare Krishna.